You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Wow.
I know.
Hi.
Now I feel the pressure.
I know.
House of Chang?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to tonight's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Aileen Lee, a partner at Cowboy Ventures and a co-founder of AllRaise. And tonight we are joined by the estimable Emily Chang, anchor and executive producer for Bloomberg Technology and author of the 2018 national bestseller, Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. Thank you so much, Emily, for being here.
Thank you. And honestly, it's an honor for me to share the stage with Aileen, who's been such a critical part of changing this industry for the better. So thank you for being here as well.
We're fortunate to have each other. Okay, so I have a bunch of questions for us to discuss tonight. But before we start, actually, can I just ask the audience to raise your hands? How many of you work at a venture-backed startup? Okay, so a good number. And then how many of you work at like a larger public technology company? So almost like a half or more than half, two-thirds of the audience work at a tech company. So that's helpful. So Emily, let's rewind the clock and talk a little bit about how you started the process of deciding that you were going to write this book. When did you first think of writing the book? Was it originally going to be called Brotopia? What was the original idea?
Well, it was originally called The Valley of Opportunity, which I thought was quite cute and sort of, you know, played off this idea of the valley between men and women. And about a year into the process, my editor called me and said, yeah, that's sweet, but how about Brotopia? And I actually remember like my stomach just dropped because it felt so strong. And my day job relies on getting tech CEOs and investors on my show and having them want to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like calling my book Brotopia might not be so welcoming.
What year was it? How long before the book came out?
That was in 2017.
Okay.
So middle of 2017.
After the election.
After the election. Uh-huh. And so things were starting to change. But, you know, I had decided to write this before me too, before Trump was elected, before any of this became part mm-hmm. of the national conversation. And there were, you know, people, you know, in my circle who didn't think it was a good idea or didn't think it was a book worth writing. Clearly that has changed. And I also came to embrace the term Brotopia. By the way, I sent them back like 500 different alternative titles. My husband knows, he's in the audience. And my agent called me, she said, well, most of these suck. You know, but what I realized is Brotopia says a lot in one word, and mm-hmm. it captures this idea of Silicon Valley as a modern utopia where anyone can change the world, anyone can make their own rules if they're a man. But if you're a woman, it's incomparably harder.
Yes.
And you asked, what was the spark?
Yeah.
And it was at the end of 2015 where I was interviewing a very prominent male venture capitalist, Chapter 5. and this man running a firm that is very successful,
interview with Michael Moritz?
Yes.
Okay.
So, Mike Moritz.
Okay.
Sequoia Capital. Has done so many incredible things in his career and invested in incredible companies. And yet they had no women at the firm at the time in their U.S. firm. And so I asked what was becoming a more standard question for me. What are you doing about hiring women? And what do you think your responsibility is? And normally I would get a very politically correct answer. People would kind of squirm. In his case, he said, well, we're looking very hard, but really what we're not prepared to do is to lower our standards. On
I know,
television.
You should groan even louder. I know.
You can go find it.
Yes.
Still on YouTube.
Yes.
And it hit me. It was like a punch in the gut.
Yeah.
And everywhere I went for the next 3 months, people wanted to talk about what he had said.
And that clip actually went quite viral, right? Like it got a lot of play.
So the next day, Vanity Fair had a story that said, here's news for all you smart, talented young women out there who want to work in tech. Apparently, you don't exist. And let's put aside what he said. Maybe he didn't mean it quite that way. Let's judge them on their actions. This is a firm that in 44 years couldn't find a single woman who met their very high standards.
Yep.
And, you know, it was a moment that you, I just had to call BS. Mm-hmm. Like, you cannot tell me you can't find one or many women.
Yeah.
Who could do a very good job.
You did a very brave thing that a lot of people in that interview would not have done. Like, you did not drop it.
Well, and look, it was, I'm not going to lie, it was scary. You know, when you cover business news, you're interviewing people, well, you know, you have to find this balance of being, you know, scrutinizing, you know, but not attacking in an unfair way. And, you know, I knew that deciding to write the book in the first place was going to be to some extent, a professional risk. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to burn down Silicon Valley. I wanted to help make Silicon Valley better. And so the book was really a journey of many conversations like that of, calling the industry out when I felt it needed to be called out.
Okay, so let's go prior. So the book came out in 2018. So 2016 to 2018, you start talking to people about this concept. And tell us about your process. How many people did you talk to?
Oh, 300 people.
Okay.
I mean,
and
hundreds.
What?
Well, I basically...
Did you know who the protagonists were going to be or like what you were going to write about? And what did you figure out in the process?
No, I had no idea. First of all, I've never written a book before. It's really hard. And I didn't know how to write a book. And there was no beginning and end to this issue. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, the Facebook story, which starts in Mark Zuckerberg's dorm room.
Right.
And so I actually didn't know where the beginning and end would be. And I had an amazing writing coach who said to me, look, if you knew the answer, it's not worth writing a book about. The fact that you don't know the answer, that this really will be a journey, that makes it worth writing about. Mm-hmm. And so I think the first chapter I wrote ended up being chapter 6. I wrote completely out of order. And it was truly a discovery process and an investigation where I learned a lot along the way and was surprised a lot along the way. And a lot of it happened just by talking to people. I mean, I do a daily show on Bloomberg Television. And so I have the opportunity where people like you are coming in every day. And I'm like, can I talk to you about something else for 5 minutes? And I would get these great tidbits and, you know, people would call me once they found out I was starting to write this and they would, you know, refer me to certain women or, you know, certain guys I should check out. And it honestly relied on the bravery of a lot of women telling me their stories. But it was not, when I started doing this, it was not like a thing.
And it wasn't obvious who were the bad actors in tech that needed, like, you know, what was rumor, what was real. So what are some of the things that you discovered?
Well, and look, Aileen is in the book and, you know, plays a very important role.
A very small.
And your book interview is actually a good example of part of the journey because I remember sitting down with you and you're like, sure, I'll do it. And you sit down and I said, so tell me about working at Kleiner Perkins.
And I was like, well, maybe I will not do it.
Yeah. And I can see you're like, oh my gosh, she said, I've never talked about this before. And so I really appreciate that. And so it was the bravery of women like you being willing to tell their story and being willing to take that personal risk, not knowing what the consequences would be. And by the way, you know, I think one of the things we forget in this whole Me Too movement is, you know, yes, a lot of men have been exposed. People have lost their jobs. You know, in some cases, women are replacing them. In some cases, you know, most cases, hopefully, you know, people who are going to behave better are replacing them. But we forget about what's happening to these women. And, you know, some of the women are thriving. Some of the women are lonely and, you know, they took these risks not knowing what was going to happen ultimately. And, I am just so grateful for their courage.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think you wrote about a number of them. Some of the women who we in the tech industry may have heard of before, like Susan Fowler. Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully you shared that story much more broadly than and outside the tech ecosystem. But a lot of individual stories, women of color, people who didn't go to Stanford or Harvard or Yale, who really kind of came to tech as outsiders and had a lot of challenges. Women in engineering, women who are more at the individual contributor or manager level, who just have had such a tough time.
So it was actually the Susan Fowler memo that came out in February of 2017. And I was writing the book in that moment. And I realized I had focused so much on trying to talk to Sheryl Sandberg and Marissa Meyer and Aileen Lee that I hadn't done enough talking to women who were really in the trenches. And so 3 weeks later, I had this dinner at my house. I had a new baby. My husband was upstairs taking care of the kids. And I'm like, oh my God, I just have to like make this work. And these 12 women engineers who worked at you know, all different kinds of companies, big and small, came to my house on a Sunday night. And it was just sort of an open forum. Well, what do you think of what Susan Fowler had to say? You know, have you had an experience like that? And it became this 4-hour, like, super emotional, none of them knew each other, you know, conversation. And they all loved what they were doing and that this opportunity to change the world, but they all felt so alone and so frustrated. And, you know, the book focuses on gender, but I think, you know, race could be a whole nother book. I think ageism is underreported in the tech industry. And we had women in the room who were, you know, quote unquote, double and triple minorities. So if you think it's hard to be a white woman engineer, imagine being a black woman engineer or a black woman engineer who didn't go to college or a Latina woman who one of them was like an emergency. She like drove ambulances and then learned how to code and was now working at Adobe. And, you know, some of them were parents and that was hard. You know, you can sort of double or triple just how hard it is when you have any other one of these identities, which is kind of like a ball and chain.
And the women who shared their stories that evening and the women that you talked to, how many of them had reported what happened to them?
Well, many of them haven't reported what happened.
Most probably have not. Right. And why? Right. Why don't,
because it's scary, because they don't want to lose their jobs, because they think maybe it's not worth it or it happened too long ago. You know, I was speaking to a woman who works as a therapist in Palo Alto, and she said it was around the Christine Blasey Ford testimony. And I said, do you think it's getting better? And she said, actually, I think it's going to start to get worse before it gets better, because you have all these women out there who are just realizing these things happened to them, realizing what has happened to them is a problem, and who are now grappling with it. Mm-hmm. And it's been sort of, you know, buried under the rug for many years.
Okay, so let's get back. We're going to kind of make this go linear again in terms of like writing the book. Did people try and talk you out of it? Did people tell you it was a bad idea or like, you know, keep it in the closet? Let's not talk about our industry's problems. Do people give you a hard time?
I vividly remember this one male investor who said to me, that's not a book, that's biology.
Really? Do you want to share who that person was?
I know you would love to hear his name.
I would.
That's not why we're here.
You can tell me later.
He literally said, women want to stay home with their kids. And he's like, honestly, my kids want to be with my wife more than they want to be with me. Why shouldn't I be here? And I was just kind of like, did you really just say that?
To a journalist?
Yeah. Let me tell you, there's so many little bits of information that if it could be published,
okay. I mean,
piles of tips on my desk that I'll never be able to action. I mean, it just takes so much time to do one of these stories. But yes, people tried to talk to me out of it and people didn't think it was a good idea. And, you know, hopefully I proved
them
wrong.
And then what about when it came out? When people read it, give us the spectrum of reactions you got from people.
The reaction that I have felt has been largely positive. And I have been invited to speak at Amazon and Microsoft and LinkedIn and YouTube and companies that easily could have said, your book is called Brotopia. No, thank you.
Right.
And they are, you know, there are employees who have filled the room. They're coming up to the microphone. They're fired up. They're asking questions. And I honestly, that has just made me feel so proud and so excited about the conversation that is happening now that wasn't happening before. And it's not all because of me. I mean, there's been some incredible journalism nationally, but in Silicon Valley in particular, the Information, the New York Times have done some incredible stories that have really made a difference. That said, there were some people who were not happy with me. There was an excerpt of the book that was published in Vanity Fair a month before the book came out that really shook a lot of people. And there were some men who were involved in that who are very powerful, who made things difficult for me.
Are we talking about sex parties? We will definitely talk about sex parties.
But overall, I have felt that has been a very tiny voice. And, you know, you can't make change without some people feeling a little bit uncomfortable, and some people feel a little bit uncomfortable.
I think that's a good thing. So what's your definition of Brotopia?
Well, you know, I, it doesn't necessarily just apply to Silicon Valley,
yeah.
but I do think it's a perfect moniker or use of the term for Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley likes to style itself as a utopia where everyone is perfect and changing the world and changing the world for the better. But it is such a misnomer, because yes, Silicon Valley and many people in Silicon Valley have done incredible things. But if you just look at the numbers, women hold 20 to 25% of jobs, 8 to 9% of venture capitalists. Women-led companies get 2% of funding in an industry that calls itself a meritocracy. How can anyone
right.
believe that this is a meritocracy?
The data does not tell the story that has been marketed about Silicon Valley.
It's ridiculous. And so, I mean, certainly you can apply the word brotopia to Wall Street and Hollywood and Washington. But I do think that Silicon Valley in many ways isn't different from these places, but it is different in the sense that it styles itself as a place that is better than right. everywhere else. And there's a sense of moral exceptionalism.
Yes.
I believe that sets Silicon Valley apart, and not in a good way. And you know, many people here, as I said, have done great things, but there's also been a lot of wealth and power amassed in a short span of time that I think can lead to a great deal of arrogance and disconnection from real world people. And some of these people are really powerful. And if they said, you know what, we need to hire more women. Actually, I want this by the end of the year. I want the numbers to change. And it would happen.
Yes, it would.
It would happen so much faster than it is happening if the leaders of these companies really made it a priority.
Yeah. Okay, we'll definitely
talk. Like, if you can build
that.
Rocket ships to Mars, you can hire more women.
Yes, that is true. That, yes, I think we should.
Thank you.
Yes, and the other thing I would add to what you said is that this is a place where people have come, a lot of immigrants have been super successful, right? So people who did not come from family money, come from like very humble beginnings. If you're an immigrant, you can be successful in Silicon Valley, just not a female one, right? Okay, so, and you alluded to this a little bit, which was one of the things that you uncovered in the book was this myth of a pipeline problem, right? Because from the inception, from the birth of Silicon Valley and the birth of the technology industry, I think it would be easy to assume that it's always been like this. And you uncovered some really interesting insights about how actually, maybe it actually has gotten worse from when we started.
So this to me was actually the smoking gun. It was not the sex parties and the cuddle puddles, shockingly.
We'll still talk about this. If
you go back to the 40s and 50s, women actually played a very prominent role in the early computing industry. Men were predominantly the makers of the hardware, but women were really well represented among software programmers. And they were programming computers for the military and programming computers for NASA. And it really was like the movie Hidden Figures, but industry-wide. And then in the 60s and 70s, as the tech industry started to explode, they were so desperate for new talent that they started doing these personality tests and aptitude tests to identify good programmers. And programming became sort of like, people thought of it as like a dark art, like, you know, this like genius thing that you just, you know, people who could do it, you just didn't really understand them. And there were these two psychologists who were men who decided that good programmers, they developed this personality test. Good programmers like solving puzzles. Okay, that makes sense. They also decided that good programmers don't like people. Anyone who can program, they don't like people. If they don't like people, they're more likely to be a good programmer. So there's no evidence to support the idea that people who don't like people are better at computers than people who do. In fact, there's a great argument to be made that you need people who like people or have empathy for the users whose problems they're trying to solve to be building the products that are supposed to be changing the world. But actually, the research tells us that if you look for people who don't like people, you're going to hire far more men than women. And I did not say that. The research says that. And women were thus essentially pushed and profiled out of an industry that they were already in. So in 1984, women hit the high point of the number of degrees they were earning in computer science. They were earning 37% of computer science degrees. That has plummeted to 18%. Where it's been flat for a decade.
So we're at a level that's basically 50% of where we were
right.
decades before.
So my argument is, yes, there is a pipeline problem now, But the tech industry created the pipeline problem. And today the tech industry reinforces the pipeline problem.
It is not an aptitude problem.
It's not an aptitude problem.
Yes.
At all.
Yeah.
It is not. And there, you know, I can't, countless women, I'm sure you, who were good at this, but dropped out, you know, girls, and we can talk about this later, you know, need encouragement every single step of the way because there are just so many forces pushing women and girls out of this industry.
Yeah.
But the tech industry can't sit here and say, oh, well, it's like an education thing. It's like teachers, parents. No. And also can't wait 10 years or 15 years for the girls who are doing Girls Who Code to get there. You know, there's so much that the industry can do now.
I mean,
to make a difference.
Even so, we'll get to the friend who said that it was a pipeline problem and that we were not willing to lower our standards, right? Because it's really important that everyone has a computer science degree. The data shows that's not true.
Well, and so the book, which is out in paperback now, has a new afterword. And I one of the companies I highlight is Redfin, which did this really interesting thing. You know, they, you know, couldn't find enough women with technical skills for their engineering team. And they had, you know, very, very few women. And so, you know, not only did they promoted a female engineer to be CTO, and she took this on. Okay, how are we going to get more women? So they started pulling women from non-traditional backgrounds. They even pulled women off their marketing team and taught them how to code. And then like a year into it, they
I like it.
I love it. A year into it, they started collecting data. Well, is this working? Are these women successful? And these women were getting promoted at the same rate as everybody else. And not only that, they had failed for many years to create a home touring product that really worked. And the home touring team was mostly men. And actually many Redfin agents in the field are women. And many of them actually don't have college degrees. And so the engineers would be a little bit snooty about their problems, like, oh, whatever. And so they made the team more diverse. And that newly diverse team decided to take a different approach. They said, maybe we should go visit the agents in the field. What a novel idea to talk to them about their problems. And they came back and this team built a product. And for the first time, it worked. And they made an extra $30 million that year.
Yay. That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about the role that venture capitalists play in the situation that we're currently in.
Wow.
venture capitalists are the king. Peter Thiel, who you asked and you note in the book, a very famous venture capitalist. You said, you know, he has a lot of thoughts about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And you asked him about what should we do about the gender disparity and the power dynamics in our industry.
And he literally said, I don't know. He literally said, I don't know what to do about that. But he can create floating ocean communities off the coast of California. And, you know, he's like drinking and eating all these things that he thinks are going to make him live forever, you know?
Yep.
And I don't want to undermine the many great things that Peter Thiel has done. But at the same time, he is part of a system that has just thrown up their hands and said, well, I don't know what to do about this. It's, you know, this is just how it is. But it's not just, it is how it is, but it's not how it has to be.
I don't even take it as this is how it is. It's that I don't feel like thinking about it.
And also,
or I'm just too lazy. It's not my problem.
He is among a group of people who doesn't take responsibility for being part of creating this problem. And Peter Thiel is a co-founder of PayPal. The other co-founder was Max Levchin. They have very different views on this. And I interview both of them in the book. You know, PayPal called itself a meritocracy. We only hire the best. They talked about it. It was a word that was frequently used at the company. And if you look at the people who succeeded at PayPal, they were all friends at Stanford and they're almost all white men. So they didn't hire the best people. They hired their friends and called it a meritocracy.
Right.
Now, Peter Thiel doesn't seem particularly, you know, worried.
Troubled by
or
the
troubled
situation.
That he did this. Whereas Max Levchin has said, yeah, we did that and it was a big mistake. And here's how I, you know, here's like when PayPal was trying to scale, it was really hard to hire women because there were no women on the team. But look at what PayPal became. All of these men who were given these opportunities because of their network went on to found Tesla and SpaceX and LinkedIn and Yammer and Yelp and YouTube. I mean, the list goes on. And guess who's on the board? Mike Moritz.
Full circle.
Didn't say that.
Okay, so VCs are part of the problem, right? Some of them just are not making an effort to think about it or to try and fix a fixable situation. What are other things that VCs tend to do to
I feel like
to
you should be answering that question.
That's very convenient that you are sitting there and I'm sitting here.
But look, VCs are the king makers of Silicon Valley. They could be the queen
makers. Yes, I was going to say, and
Silicon
queen makers,
Valley. They could be. But they are the ones who are deciding, you know, what gets $25 million and gets a chance to succeed. And you could look at like a company like Uber, which has gotten billions and billions of dollars in funding. And you could look at a company like Rent the Runway, which is very successful, run by a woman. Aileen is an investor, which has gotten hundreds of millions of dollars in funding. Well, Uber has so many more chances to figure it out and get it right. So many more years of runway than Rent the Runway has. And that is where the disparity lies. You know, you could even look at, it's not just about how many women are getting funded. It's, well, how much money are they getting?
Mm-hmm.
Who's writing those, you know, how big right. are the checks? Stitch Fix is a perfect example where Katrina Lake had this idea, you know, personalized clothing for women. And she talked to 50 venture capitalists who were almost all men who said no. Because they didn't understand.
Or I checked with my wife, right. and she said she would not use it.
Or I asked my assistant, you know, yeah. they'd call the assistant into the room. And Katrina tells a great story because at the time, a lot of T-ball apps were getting funded. And she'd kept on seeing like T-ball apps in TechCrunch. And she's just like, these VCs, they're just investing in their son's T-ball league. She's very realistic and practical about it. She's like, I want, you know, if investors are only making one or two investments a year, I want them to be passionate about the idea, but it just really works against me if all VCs are men. But what this forced her to do is she basically had to bootstrap her company, and she did get, you know, other investors along the way, but her company was profitable much sooner than most Silicon Valleys are profitable. And she took the company public at it's a $2 billion valuation. So yep. all of those investors made a big mistake.
Yep. So VC being extremely male dominated impacts who gets funded. It impacts how much, generally by gender and potentially by race or ethnicity, how much people get. It doesn't really speak to, and it's hard to quantify, how many people never get a first shot. Like how many people have a horrible first meeting because they get groped in a meeting or somebody says something inappropriate and racist and they walk out and they say, tech's not for me. Mm-hmm. Because of, I think, the composition of the VC industry.
There's also, I mean, very concrete research that, you know, we don't use the word visionary and genius generally to describe women. We use that word to describe dozens and dozens of men. And so male and female entrepreneurs in the boardroom are perceived completely differently. Qualities that are seen as positive in men are seen as negative in women. Men who are young are high potential. Women who are young are inexperienced.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when a man is a little cautious, that's like, oh, that's interesting. When a woman
He's
is
thoughtful
cautious,
and patient.
Total red flag.
Yeah.
And what has been really interesting is to these male and female husband and wife teams. I interviewed the
Aditya
founders
Tarko.
Of this smart
yeah.
breast pump company
oh, okay.
called Naya, and they're, you know, husband and wife team, and they would both go into the same meetings, and she would get all the questions about their kids. I'd be like, oh, how many kids do you have? Oh, you have three kids. Oh, how are you going to do this? And she's like, he has the same exact kids. And so, and women often get asked yeah. questions about children and family, and investors don't seem to believe that. And you got asked, I write about this in the book. You got asked this question.
I did.
Tell them the question that you got asked.
I was raising my first fund, and I was meeting with some gentlemen from the South. And we were having a meeting, and about halfway through the meeting, I'm fundraising, and it's my firm is just me. And they said, so tell me about your, you know, outside of work. What do you like to do outside of work? And I, like, do you have any hobbies? And I was like, well, you know, we have three kids, so I don't really have that much time for hobbies. And they're like, what? You have three kids? How are you going to do this? How do you make this work? And I was like, oh boy, it's only 20 minutes into the meeting. How are we going to end this? And I said to them, I said, do you guys have kids? How do you do it?
Absolutely.
Anyway. All right. So we talked a little bit about the role of VCs. And then what about the role of founders?
Well, I mean...
Because founders are
yes.
the superstars, right? They're the kings of Silicon Valley.
And they also have incredible power to, at a very early stage, you know, change the course of the
who they invite to invest in their company,
the better.
Who they hire, how they allocate the equity in their company.
So this is really interesting. I mean, I first of all, the smaller you are, the easier this is to do, and then the easier your diverse team is mm-hmm. to scale. I was talking to Aaron Levy, the CEO of Box, who's been very supportive, and Box was four young white men who started the company, and he said, I said something like, If you just look for people who don't look like you in the beginning, it'll be so much easier for you to grow that. And he was like, if someone had just told me that early on, like, it would have been so much easier. You know, you need to look for people who have different life experiences than you. And often that does involve looking for people who don't look like you, who are a different gender than you, different sexuality, different education level, coming from a different part of the country. That is the best way to ensure that you have balance on your team and that you will come up with the best ideas. Like, you cannot tell me that having, you know, a bunch of people in the room who all think the same way, that you'll come up with the best idea.
I mean, part of the problem is that has been a lot of the secret to success in tech. And so they look at Sequoia or Benchmark or Airbnb
or
Amazon, and they say, like, it was all founded by white men.
Some people have made the argument that less diversity is better early on because you can move faster. You all agree. But it actually, and like Max Levchin from PayPal said, like, look, it came back to bite us. And honestly, we just don't know. We know what we have now. But I think about all the women who never got a chance to start the next Apple or mm-hmm. Google or Facebook or Twitter, and how different the world might be, or the women who didn't get a chance to be on one of these teams. Ev Williams, the co-founder of Twitter, told me he thinks if they had more women on the early Twitter team, that online harassment and trolling wouldn't be such a problem. He said, we weren't thinking
it's
about it.
Not too late. yeah, and also just when you look at the wealth that's been created by the tech ecosystem and the billionaires that have a huge impact on our economic and political landscape today, imagine if there had been women on those co-founding teams. I mean, so let's talk a little bit about, so it's been a year, right? Let's talk a little bit about, you added some stuff to the book that about what's happened and what you've learned in the past year. So let's talk a little bit about that.
I would say that change is happening. But change is happening slowly. And, you know, we're seeing some boards become more diverse. A conversation is certainly happening that was not happening before. We have seen an incredible amount of employee activism.
Yes.
And that has made a difference. You know, we saw 20,000 employees walk out of Google in response to a New York Times story about how the company handled sexual misconduct, turned a blind eye to it, paid men who had been accused of things enormous sums of money, let them leave quietly, and then invested in their next thing. And employees, you know, rightly so, walked out and said, like, we're not going to stand for this.
Yeah.
We don't want our hard-earned money going to pay, like, somebody who's been accused of sexual harassment. And Google has actually changed some of its policies as a result. There's still a lot of work to be done, but forced arbitration, many people don't quite understand, when you go to work at a tech company, you basically have to take a vow of silence and sign an NDA and agree to, if something goes wrong, you can never say anything about it and you have to settle it in private. Now at Google, you can, if you have a case of any kind, you can actually take that case to court. Many companies have also since ended forced arbitration for sexual harassment because of the Me Too movement and the exposure to these issues. Amazon, shareholders pressured Amazon to diversify their board. And actually, they've added two female board members in, I believe, the last month. And now almost half the board mm-hmm. is women.
Yep.
And so...
And you wrote something about if they do, maybe they will, maybe they won't do it, at New York headquarters, about how they should think about staffing and teaming that.
Yes. Yeah, so I wrote an op-ed in Bloomberg Business Week with a couple colleagues where I said... with HQ2, Amazon has a huge opportunity to start from scratch and hire 50% women. Like, why not?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Don't you think it's
right,
a great idea?
You know, and I believe, like, Jeff Bezos has done a lot of incredible things. He's shown that, like, he can change the world. And I fully believe if he put his mind to this, he could do it.
Did you get a reaction?
you know, I got... People were generally supportive.
Yeah.
Amazon declined to comment.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco
at inforumsf.org.
Okay, what are other things that have happened in the past year? I guess we could talk about, the Google walkout had positive impact on Google, but we also learned, I think, in the past week that there's $150 million yes. more that was personally approved by the CEO of Alphabet to pay off Andy Rubin.
What we learned is that Larry Page personally approved a $150 million exit package for Andy after Andy had been accused of sexual harassment. It ultimately ended up being $90 million. But Andy left the company, heroes farewell, and Google then went on to invest in Playground, his next company. And it is just a perfect example of where things go wrong. Google also paid Amit Singhal, another man who was accused of sexual harassment, $45 million, and Larry personally approved that.
So are you hearing from employees? Like, will they? I mean, I think one of the great things that has happened with this employee activism is that people can vote with their time, right? They can vote by no longer working at companies that do that kind of stuff. They can go work at Cowboys Ventures-backed companies or companies that have modern leadership that basically make a commitment to equal pay and demonstrating what they value by who's on the cap table, who's on the board, who's on the leadership team. Do you see that happening more?
You know, I definitely think there's certainly a trend towards people who are looking for jobs thinking harder about culture. And is this a place where I can be myself and be, you know, more productive? And, I think that employees now have far more power than they've ever had before. To speak up, to make change, to vote with their feet if things aren't going well. Slack, for example, you know, has really taken this on, and it's come from the top. The CEO, Stuart Butterfield, is very focused on hiring more women and minorities. He tweets about it. Every time he tweets, they get a spike in inbound interest, and it's becoming a competitive advantage for them. Yeah. Like, people want to work at Slack. Not just women, but guys too. People, it's a cool place to work. It's a place that people think, oh, this company gets it.
Yeah.
And so I do think that this is and can be and certainly should be a competitive advantage for the companies that care about it.
And is that one of the things you've seen since
you
wrote the book?
And I also think it's impacting venture capital firms, you know?
Yeah.
You know, some of the storied, legendary venture capital firms that have been so male-dominated aren't as cool anymore. Look, is it the right call? I mean, these decisions could take 10 years.
And some firms have hired female partners for the first time, but it's totally a coincidence.
And there's a lot of firms that have hired their first partner. Yay! I mean, we need 2, 3, 4. Like, it's not enough to have one. And, you know, in my view, in order to have a real culture change in this industry, we need to get close to 50-50. Like, if you have 10 men around a dinner table, the conversation is a certain way. If you add one woman, like, maybe the conversation changes like a little, but if it's half and half, it's a completely different conversation.
Yes.
And by the way, should like all the chairs be filled by women? No, not necessarily. There's this amazing study that the IMF did. If you get to more than 60% women on boards or on an executive team, that's when you start to see diminishing returns. And so it really is that balance.
It's about balance.
That is better.
Yeah. So we talked about Redfin. We talked about Slack. What are other things? I mean, you also talked about the importance of the commitment of the CEO. Right? Like, what are things that people are trying that seem to be working or making a difference? What's important? Like, if anyone out here is a manager or a CEO or wants to be part of making a difference, what are things that people should be doing?
So what has worked at Slack is, and I interview Joelle Emerson in the book, who is, I don't know if diversity consultant is the right word, but she's been working with a lot of different companies in Silicon Valley mm-hmm. to help them with this. And the way she puts it is if you just focus on unconscious bias training or raising awareness about bias, that's not necessarily going to have a huge impact, because we all have bias, men and women, and it's really hard to change how you feel about someone or something. And you don't even necessarily know when your bias is impacting your decisions. So what you really have to do is give people the tools to combat their bias. And so that means, you know, standardizing your interview process, making sure you're asking every candidate the same set of questions. If somebody comes in and they look the part, like, you know, they're a white guy from Stanford wearing a hoodie with a computer science degree, like you think, oh, this guy can do the job. And if somebody comes in with a non-traditional background and they don't look the part, you might ask them tougher questions. And that's where the bias creeps in. I mean, you also have to do that with your review and feedback systems. And we haven't talked about this yet, but it's not just about hiring. It's about retention. Sounds like retaining water. Somebody wants to do that. progression and advancement, yeah. And make sure that you are progressing and advancing the women that you have. Yes. Women are twice as likely to leave tech as they are to leave other fields. And they're not leaving to take care of children and families. They're going to jobs in other industries. And so that is why it's so important that it's not just about diversity, it's about inclusion. And diversity, yes, it will take time. But inclusion starts today. You know, you can work on the culture of your team and whether people have a voice on that team, like right now. And even if you're not the CEO, if you're just a member of a team or you're building mm-hmm. something, you have the capacity in your own little, you know, microcosm of your company to make that difference and to look for those people who, again, don't look like you.
Absolutely. Amen to that. You are also very, I think, sensitive in the book around that. Yes, we have big gender problems in the industry, but we have a lot of what we call like problems with people from intersectional backgrounds in terms of we have so many underrepresented groups in technology. And I think you are very sensitive to those issues. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you've learned about that? Because I think it's easy to just cut at tech and say it's a gender problem. But yeah. When you peel the onion, a lot of people from different backgrounds have not been given a first chance.
That night that I had those 12 engineers mm-hmm. at my house, there was a woman named Lydia Fernandez who is an engineer at Uber, which was, you know, ironic because Fowler had just written this explosive memo. For the first 20 years of her life, Lydia Fernandez was presenting as a man. And I didn't realize this, but I actually interviewed her when she was presenting as a man because she was going through the Code 2040 program. But just before she started working at Uber, she made her transition. And she said the way people treated her completely changed. And the way she described it, she said, I have 20 years of life experience of people telling me my opinion matters, people wanting to hear what I have to say. And then suddenly people just would start cutting me off mid-sentence. And her words, she said, this game is rigged. I have sat on both sides of this table. Like, there's not many people out there who have lived life from the perspective of both a man and a woman who can sort of crystallize how different it is. And what's amazing about her is she'll be like, excuse me, let me finish speaking. And people will double take.
Yeah.
Because they're not used to a woman saying, don't cut me off. Which, by the way, we were talking about this in the green room with KT, you know, one thing that I think is so great about this movement is, you know, there's a lot of talk and we need action too, but I think we can all feel more empowered to call these things out when yes. we see them. And it is so much easier to advocate for someone else than for you if you're the victim or if you're being interrupted to be like, excuse me, like I'm being mansplained. Can you stop that? It's easier for you to be like, hey, I want to finish hearing what she has to say.
Yeah.
Or I think so-and-so needs to get an opportunity. And, you know, I was on a phone with an investor today and you know, giving me this great pitch and all these great men who are helping him. And I said, I just hope that you have some women who are helping you too. And he's like, oh yeah, 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 yeah. And I have so many women on my team. And like, honestly, I was like, you know, I wasn't scared to say that anymore.
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, that might make a difference. Just that little comment. It doesn't need to be a public dress down. You can maybe pull someone aside after a meeting. That is something that all of us can do.
Yes, absolutely. I want to get to something you said earlier about the game is rigged. Right. To bring it to, I think, like a modern current event, the college admissions scandal. does it surprise you that a good number of the people that have been surfaced by this case are from the Bay Area and in the tech industry?
Oh, my
industry?
Gosh. We were just talking about this. I'm like, how do I know? I know these people. Bill McGlashan has been on my show many times. Okay. It's horrifying. And it goes to this idea of meritocracy, which is a word that we use in Silicon Valley a lot, but a true meritocracy is impossible to achieve. And if you actually look at the origin of the term, the person who coined that term actually meant it as a warning. It was this British sociologist in the 1950s named Michael Young, who said, I'm seeing a dangerous trend of people using their wealth, education, and privilege to justify their wealth, education, and privilege. This could have dangerous consequences. But somehow meritocracy ended up becoming this ideal that only the best rise to the top, and we are striving to be and achieve a meritocracy. And he started hearing it in the speeches of Tony Blair, which is so fascinating. Let me get to this. So Michael Young, 50 years later, wrote an op-ed in The Guardian where he said, this term meritocracy, I meant it like to describe dystopia, and it's now being used to describe utopia. And what's amazing is I interviewed Tony Blair on Tuesday, and I saved this question for the end. I was like, so I have a personal question about this word meritocracy, which you used in some of your speeches. And I just, do you know about the controversy around the term? And he's like, oh yes. And he knew who Michael Young was. And I was like, well, would you still use that term today? And he was like, well, no, I wouldn't use it. I mean, I don't use it because he's, you know, in British society, he felt it meant something very specific, you know, breaking away from the class system where certainly the ideal is that people rise to the top based on merit. But it doesn't mean that if you were not successful that you had no merit. That's what it's unfortunately come to mean. And that he's like, I didn't mean it that way at all. And so I was, you know, it felt like, you know, this was coming full circle. I'm like, okay, things are changing. If we could just get rid of this term. I mean, the college admission scandal is a perfect example that this world is not a meritocracy.
It's a meritocracy
where people hire people who look like them.
And people with privilege think that the rules may not apply to them.
Yeah, I...
Okay, so we have 5 minutes left. we could talk about that for another hour.
I know.
All right, we have five minutes left, so we're going to move to Q&A in 5 minutes. So if you do have questions, maybe you can start moving to the back or thinking about your questions. All right, so let's talk about the future. And I guess there are people in the audience. We talked about some of the things you can do to make a difference if you're hiring, but we can talk a little bit about building products and artificial intelligence. And how do we make sure that we don't replicate the mistakes of the past where meritocracy accidentally became what I think is like merit's interest, which is stuff that's like me, right? And that we basically accidentally dismantled the formerly more balanced tech ecosystem and made it more skewed because of bias ingrained in our systems. And we're about to embark on this whole new age of software controlling a lot of our industries and a lot of the decisions that may have bias baked into it.
Can you tell Aileen has thought about this?
how do we advise the tech industry to break the habits of the past?
Well, write a book about it. I mean, here's why this is important. Like, Amazon has this new facial recognition technology that they're marketing to governments and police departments. And it gets white men right almost 100% of the time. And it gets darker skinned women wrong 35% of the time. So imagine being accused of something because the tech got it wrong. That is why this matters. You know, some of these decisions aren't necessarily malicious. It's just that men have been building this technology for so long. The data sets are, you know, male dominated. And so these problems just get built into the systems. And tech has this enormous potential to challenge inequality or reinforce and re-enshrine the inequalities and bias that already exists. You know, that is why this matters. And I think it is tangible examples like that. It's really hard to say what if. Well, what if women had been, you know, had a seat at the table? Can't really answer that question.
Right.
But it's finding those kind of examples and saying, look, this is why this matters. And guess who figured this out? Two black female researchers. That's who figured this out. That is why we need women and minorities in the room and people who don't think like you in the room.
Yeah, lots of different people represented. All right, we didn't really get to talk about sex or cuddle puddles, but we do have a couple more minutes left. So in your research, was there a lot of sex and drugs and rock and roll and like weird touching going on in technology?
So, you know, what I found was that there is or was a, you know, smaller subset of the Silicon Valley population that was engaging in these things. And, you know, in some ways it makes sense. You know, the Bay Area has always been this place of sexual liberation, sexual freedom. That is not the problem. Sex parties are not the problem. The problem is mixing business and pleasure in an environment where the power dynamic vastly favors men. And so you had many powerful men in the scene who actually happened to know each other or invest in each other's companies and could pat each other on the back. Whereas if you were a woman and you wanted to explore your sexuality, you are discredited if you
participate. Or if you wanted to keep your job.
Or you are shut out if you don't show up. It's like a catch-22. And, you know, this culture, I mean, I talked to a female co-founding team where one of the women decided to participate, one of the women didn't, and they both got shut out, essentially. And it also broke them up. Literally an investor in this scene said to me, well, I've seen them naked at Burning Man, I probably wouldn't want to hire them. Well, that doesn't apply to the guys. I have heard from my sources that scene has calmed down since the book, since the broader Me Too movement, and people are being more thoughtful about business and pleasure. It doesn't mean bad behavior isn't still happening. I'm sure bad behavior is still happening. I've heard that some of the activity has become, you know, more private, moved off to like Ibiza. but I just want people to be thinking about these things when they're making these decisions. You know, it's what is happening you think in private can have these really devastating consequences for women who have no power.
Yeah. I mean, I think if there is a silver lining to this horrible scandal is like the CEOs that we hold up that got in trouble or the fund managers that got in trouble for bad behavior, where no one wants to be that guy, right? No one wants to be the person whose fund was shut down because it turned out that stuff that you thought was private came out in public, right? And no one wants to be one of the names that's been listed endlessly in the press over the past 2 days because people thought they were above the law or the rules didn't apply to them. And I think hopefully these serve as lessons to the tech community that that the rules should apply to all of us.
Absolutely.
Okay. We'll do a little wrap, but we're going to go to questions. And so we've got some questions in the back. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you both so much for having this conversation in public, you know, not just tonight, but in general. I spent 12 years in tech sales, and everything you talked about, I saw and happened to me. And I had someone say to me, we're not willing to lower our standards. That's why there aren't more women. My question is, now I've moved out of the industry to help more female founders with my sales skills. Where do I go to do that? How do I plug into helping more?
Well, there's this great thing called All Rage that is doing amazing things. I feel like you can best answer that question.
Well, I think there are All Rage and a number of nonprofits that have been born. Some have been around for a long time, like Girls Who Code or Black Girls Who Code, and All Rage, which is newer, which are basically trying to, at All Rage, our mission is to increase and accelerate the success of women in the tech ecosystem, either as founders or as funders. And so trying to figure out what are the skills that founders in particular or teams need help with, and how do we get them that help? What's the insight? What are the introductions? What are the connections? What are the skills that they need? And how do we get that to them? Because for many years, they've been alone. So we can talk afterwards.
Yeah, can I email
Thank you?
Okay, great.
Hello. Hi, Emily and Aileen. You guys are my heroes, so thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I wanted to tell you a little story. I was listening to This Week in Startups, Jason Calacanis' podcast, and Keith Raboy was on. Jason asked him, what has been happening in terms of more funding going to women? And what have you guys been doing at Colsa at the time? And Keith said, well, we offer better, more term sheets to women-led companies and better deal terms. And Jason asked him why. And he's like, well, because we're more conscious about giving more money to underrepresented minorities. And to me, that's just like, you know, wrong. That's not why that's happening. So if these guys still don't get it, they don't get it after Brotopia, they don't get it after All Rage, they don't get it after the stuff that happened with Google and with Susan Fowler, like what on earth is it going to have to happen for them to finally get like what the actual problem is? Like, do we have to wait for them to die or something to replace them? Or what can I do today
you
to make that happen?
You should stay up there and ask more questions.
So I think other people and companies they don't fund are going to have to make a lot of money. and they're going to say, wow, we really missed that. And hopefully that's happening a little bit. Like, hopefully it happened with Stitch Fix. But, you know, some of these people we're just going to have to agree to disagree with. And, you know, hopefully there are enough of us out there that are talking more loudly.
So at All Raise, we do have this initiative called Founders for Change, and it's a movement of founders who stand up and make a public commitment to inclusion and diversity on their teams, on their boards, and on their cap tables. And I do think increasingly, once founders have product market fit and they're not worried about going out of business and they realize they're going to have choices, they can vote by who they invite to invest in their company. They can look at a website and realize that the reality is the economic power in a firm is dominated by a handful of all white males, and that the website has put women and people of color on there who are on the, like, important, but they're not controlling the economics of the firm. And we've gotten emails and heard stories from Founders for Change who call us and be like, you're never going to believe what happened. I got an inbound because, like, I'm doing great and my company's really hot and a lot of people are chasing me. And this firm that looks like it's Mad Men has been hounding me. And I said, hey, guy, thanks for your interest, but I'm a founder for change. And I went to your website and I saw what it looks like. And I am trying to build a modern company and it doesn't look like we're going to be a fit. So if you want to get coffee, I'm happy to get coffee to tell you how I can help you try and change your firm, but I'm not interested.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Hi, thank you both. Your work's been super inspirational for me. My question is about warning signs for organizations. So a lot of times I work with leadership teams who say, diversity is not really an issue for us. And we say, yes, it is. I promise it is. Just because you don't have a Susan Fowler out there yet doesn't mean there aren't issues. So what are some of the early signs that you can point to in a culture or events happening that you can raise the flag a little earlier and intervene before it's sort of a burning platform?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, it's interesting. I was speaking to the CEO of Coinbase, which, you know, they don't want to be the blockchain bros and are, you know, founded by a couple of guys. And they've made diversity one of their OKRs, objectives and key results, that they discuss every single month. And they've, you know, set a specific target, like they're focused on getting more women into management because they believe that if they can get more women into management, those women will hire more women below them. And it's just one specific thing that they can focus on. And I just think that you have to track the data. Like, if someone says to you, well, we don't have a problem, okay, let's get the numbers. Let's see what the numbers look like. And let me tell you a story. I do a tech show every day. Every day I'm looking for like 8 guests. And it's a lot. It's hard. I can't sit here and say it's too hard, but it is. It's hard to every day find 8 people who can, you know, speak smartly about a certain subject. And I'm covering the tech industry, which is already male dominated. And, you know, so every day I'm like, we need more women on our show. We need more women on our show. And a year ago, our editor in chief, John Micklethwaite, said, we need more women on our shows. And after he said that, my whole team just like charged into gear. And we now have to count the number of women on our show every single day, send it to someone. And at the end of the month, we get a report back on how well we did. And sometimes we see the numbers and we're like, you know, and sometimes we're like, oh, that was better than we thought. And it is so important to have that data for yourself. And it just doesn't lie. The data does not lie. And so I just think that's the most important thing.
I think that's is totally important, tracking
how you're doing.
But I think there's also, you know, there are cultural things, right? Like, if you, because talent, especially if you live in the Bay Area, you have lots of choices if you're working in a tech company, right? Pretty much every company wants to hire you. You have a lot of choices, most likely. And so, you know, if you hear of a situation where someone has a situation where they got interrupted or mansplained repeatedly in a meeting, or someone had a sexual harassment or a problem and they reported it to HR or their manager and their manager did not do anything about it, like, you have the opportunity to escalate. And if it doesn't get resolved, look around. Right? Because I think, you know, we have to feed the companies that are treating people with respect, and we can kind of starve the ones who are not.
Thank you. First, fangirl of both of you. I've read Emily's book. It's incredible. I work for a company that was founded by two black male founders who are on Founders for Change. We're on the website. We have it on our website as well. They're very supportive of me being a woman in aerospace engineering and the work that I do to create a community around that.
You go, girl.
Yeah.
Thank you. But we have taken money from some of the big bros in Silicon Valley. We will probably likely take more money from the bros in Silicon Valley, as supportive as they are. And I've watched, I know personally, professionally, somebody that you recently interviewed, and it was like horrifying because I know that they're not
a good person.
A good person. They're not in line with your values that
after?
You outline in the book. Yeah. So how do we live in this world where you've got to interview people and a lot of them are probably bros and are probably the people that you'll end up writing about in a couple of years? And how do we take money from people who will probably be in your book?
Can you just, like my biggest fear. My biggest fear was that I was going to give a platform to someone who did deserve it, or had skeletons in their closet. And, you know, I had to do my homework and I have people like Aileen who will like help give me the skinny.
Is one of your interview questions like, do you have a secret dungeon in your basement with people handcuffed?
And so that's how, you know, but I don't, you know, I generally don't want to be giving a platform to those people. And I want to be giving a platform to people who make a difference. I mean, I think you would have a better answer to, you know, when are some of these super prominent venture capitalists who you might call bros, when will founders not want to take money from those people?
I think it's happening more than ever before. And I think people, like the venture capital industry used to be more of a black box. But a lot of founders, I mean, they know so much about the industry and how it works. And they understand that partners at these firms that manage billions of dollars, they make a lot in fee income just for showing up every day, even if they're not that good at their job. And I think founders are onto it.
Hi, Emily. Hi, Aileen. Thank you guys so much. My question's a little bit different. I work for a large open source nonprofit, and we definitely talk a lot about the lack of diversity on the team and what we can do to improve it. It's a big point of conversation. But a little bit on the other side of it, we also talk about how the lack of open source and the change in Silicon Valley culture has contributed to business models, especially to the way companies make profit, that are very conducive to discrimination. And especially when we're getting into VR and XR and the way that data is collected, and that at this point, we're not really looking at individual privacy. We're looking at our privacy as a whole, and we're looking at data being collected about certain groups of people and generalization being made by machines or by people who are basically not part of those groups. And a part of the conversations in our office is that one of the ways to address that is to open things up more, just to give people more access. And I just wanted to ask if that's something you've encountered or what your opinion is on that.
Open the product to give people more access to it so you get feedback from users?
Yeah. And also essentially bringing in developers that have more diverse backgrounds.
I mean, to me, that seems to be like a good strategy. I think about a company like Facebook, where literally until today, the top 15 people on Mark Zuckerberg's product team, 14 of them were men. And I believe, and the research bears this out, that women have different views on privacy and data privacy than men do, because women are treated differently and experience the internet differently than men, just like they do real life. And so privacy, I think, is an issue that is like literally one of the biggest issues of our time, where I think that our privacy might have been treated a lot differently if there had been more women running these companies. So I would 100% say that, I mean, I think your company should hire more people of diverse backgrounds, but they need to be at the table, have a voice at the table. You need to be consulting, you know, women and minority groups, you know, talking to EFF, talking to, you know, survivors of domestic violence about all of these, you know, implications that your product can have that you might not think about because you don't have those life experiences.
Great answer.
Thank you.
Mark Zuckerberg did just promote someone to the head, a woman to be the head of the Facebook app.
Good.
Which I think is really important.
Thank you so much. As a female founder, what advice can you give me? And my co-founder is also female, and the data basically says we're doomed.
No, so, you're not doomed.
And as I run a group of other female founders, and we're all chatting, we're all trying to share our strategies and stuff. But what it's come down to, if you don't have a warm intro, if you don't have an in, it's really hard to get funding.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why a number of women, like it's a very large group of women who have been in the industry for a long time, started All Raise together, because it shouldn't have to be that way. And so I think hopefully, I don't know if you've reached out or not, but like we do office hours with founders and with venture capitalists specifically for women at seed stage or pre-seed stage to give you a safe place to be able to get feedback on your pitch, to ask questions. We've done thousands of them, and it's really sad the questions that people have, because they have, maybe some of them have done fundraising, and like very common is a co-founding team with a man and a woman where the woman is the CEO and the man is head of product. And she'll be like, what should I do when I pitch a bunch of VCs and they only make eye contact with my co-founder and they only ask him questions and they ignore me and ask me to get coffee? This happens in 2019. It's crazy, but more like, and that's wrong. It shouldn't be like that. But like more than ever, I think the good people in the technology industry and in business realize that that's wrong and we want to fix it. And I think there's more opportunities than ever to fix it.
The last thing that I would want, and I know Aileen would want, is to discourage women from being in this industry or trying to start a company. I mean, I think the world needs you now more than ever. And I mean, because you haven't had opportunities before, like you really can make a difference. And like, who knows what's possible if more women are building, you know, the products and services that are changing the world. Like maybe we really will change the world for the better.
Yes, I think we will. It's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Wow. What I would say is don't settle for the status quo. This is how it is, but this is not how it has to be. Like, you can make a difference. You alone can make a difference. And certainly you together and we can make a difference if we decide to change this. We can hire more women. We can fund their ideas. We can make sure they're paid fairly. If we can build rockets to Mars and self-driving cars and connect the world, surely we can do this. Did that work?
Well, I, for one, will be voting for Emily Chang for president in 2020. I don't know why you're doing this journalism job, really. Thank you so much for all the work you have done. I always, whenever I watch your show, and every day the topic is different, and you know about fuel cells and Japanese markets and artificial intelligence and bias, and like, it's amazing. The depth of your knowledge and your intelligence, but also your empathy. It's just, you're really a leader. And thank you for stepping up for writing this incredible book. It really is a service to all of us, and we thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.